At least two Israelis are killed in a suspected retaliatory shooting in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military continues deadly attacks on Palestinians. President Raisi meets with an Iranian diplomat recently freed from a Belgian prison, criticizing his arrest as a precedented violation of diplomatic immunity. And the political situation is getting more complicated in Pakistan as the country's opposition leader is detained on unclear charges. At least two Israelis have been killed following a suspected Palestinian shooting operation in the occupied West Bank. Israeli media says that those killed are in their 30s and 60s. The shooting happened at a car wash near the town of Har. A manhunt is underway for the shooters. The resistance movement Hamas has held the operation and vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli regime. Tensions are high in the occupied West Bank, with Israeli forces performing deadly raids on Palestinian towns. In the latest development, a teenager succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid near Nablus on Wednesday. Palestinians have also performed retaliatory operations, which have led to the injury of Israelis in the past few months. On the World Humanitarian Day, Palestinians in Gaza see no end in sight to their suffering in light of the unabated Israeli human rights violations. Israel maintains a suffocating land, air, and sea blockade and carries out frequent military incursions into the tiny coastal sliver.
In 2008, the UN General Assembly proclaimed the 19th of August as World Humanitarian Day, but years on, Palestinians, especially in the blockaded Gaza Strip, continue to suffer because of Israeli human rights violations. Israel systematically pursues policies and practices and blatant violation of international law. Gazans have been denied freedom of movement and the freedom to use their own natural resources. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars have undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive. The Israeli regime prevents sustainable growth in the tiny coastal territory and perpetuates the already high level of food insecurity, unemployment, and aid dependency.
We are calling on the international community in order to apply the humanitarian principles in Palestine, mainly in Gaza. And first, to have protection for the Palestinian civilians who are suffering from unemployment, food security, and poverty due to this blockade.
On World Humanitarian Day, the Gaza Strip continues to descend into poverty and de-development, the watchful eye of the international community.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on all nations to stand by the Palestinian people because they have been suffering for decades under Israeli occupation. World Humanitarian Day must be used to highlight the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Palestinians are left to fend for themselves as the world continues to turn a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of international laws and norms.
Palestinians have been suffering under appalling conditions for many years. Observers say the inhumane Israeli practices have essentially deprived Palestinians of their individual and collective rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says that the Israeli regime is on path to collapse and is facing a difficult situation both internally and externally. Brigadier General Ismail Rouhani says that recently there have been 15 to 13 attacks a day by resistance forces against the Tel Aviv occupied in the West Bank. He said that the acts of resistance has the upper hand now. He cited the regime's gas row with Lebanon, saying that the Arab country could not restore its gas rights in the Mediterranean Sea without Hezbollah resistance movement. He was referring to a recent maritime deal reached between the regime and Lebanon that demarcated Lebanese maritime border. President Raisi has met with an Iranian man recently freed from a Belgian prison, congratulating him on his patience and resilience during his time in jail. In the meeting, Ibrahim Raisi censured Asadullah's arrest as an unprecedented violation of his diplomatic immunity. He said that self-proclaimed champions of human rights showed once again that they are bound by no law. The Iranian diplomat was arrested in 2018 in Germany and later transferred to Germany. There he was sentenced to 20 years in prison over a conviction of playing a role in a plot to bomb a meeting of MK terrorist group in France. Assad denied all the charges. He was released last May following Iran's diplomatic efforts. Tehran says that his conviction was a result of a plot designed by Israel and carried out by some Western intelligence services. Iran's foreign minister, Amin Abdullahian, says that coups, soft and hard wars, and sanctions are all tools of hegemonic powers to suppress the will of independence. He made a comment on the anniversary of the 1953 U.S.-UK-led coup d'etat in Iran that led to the overthrow of then-Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. A correspondent has more.
The street I'm on today in Tehran is named after Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, a familiar name among Iranian people, which is closely related to words such as oil, England, the U.S., and most importantly, coup. With the efforts of the then Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran's oil industry was nationalized in 1952. This meant putting an end to British control over the country's oil industry. The UK and the US made joint attempts to regain control over Iranian oil, but to no avail. Eventually, the British government severed its diplomatic relations with Iran. This hostility led to a plotted coup against Mossadegh in 1953.
The UN and the UK feared that they lose control over Iran's sources, especially oil, because Mossadegh had nationalized oil and had taken the power and the control of the oil industry in Iran away from the British and give back to the Iranians.
The coup was orchestrated by the U.S. against the democratically elected government of Mossadegh under the excuse of the fear of Iran falling into the hands of communism and the Soviet Union during the Cold War era.
The U.S. was fight at that time of communism, and so they thought Iran was going to join the communist, or their propaganda was that Iran was going to join the communist bloc, even though they knew it wouldn't, because Iran was trying to play a neutral game, a very, very non-aligned game.
The overthrow of Mossadegh was planned by the CIA, a plan which consisted of gaining the trust of Mossadegh's government, a trust which was broken by Washington later on.
The U.S. initially supported nationalization of the Iranian oil industry to win the trust of the Iranian government. However, after participating in the coup, the U.S. sought its own domination over the country's oil resources, trusting America was a mistake made by the Iranian government.
But the coup was just the beginning of open hostility with Iran.
The beginning of the hostility between Iran and America was certainly from the side of the American government itself.
The memory of the 1953 coup among Iranians is a bitter one, a reminder of imperialist intervention that may have sparked the revolution some 20 years after. Farzana Shuryan, Tehran.
Iran and Saudi Arabia are making further progress in strengthening ties. Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian traveled to Saudi Arabia on Thursday. There were talks with senior officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Amir Abdullahian described his discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. That was his first visit to the Arab Kingdom since reconciliation between the two countries earlier this year.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has paid a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Amir Abdullahian to the city of Jeddah. It was the first time a senior Iranian official met with the Saudi Crown Prince. In their meeting, both officials reviewed bilateral ties and explored future opportunities for cooperation between Tehran and Riyadh. They also discussed the latest international and regional developments. Abdullah reiterated Iran's determination to improve relations with countries in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia play a leading role in the region and the Muslim world. He underscored the need to boost dialogue as well as development-oriented ties as the path to success in the region. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, extends his own and Saudi King's greetings to Iran leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ibrahim Raisi. Bin Salman said Saudi Arabia views the partnership with Iran as strategic. He reiterated Riyadh's invitation to the Iranian president to travel to Saudi Arabia. Before meeting bin Salman, the top Iranian diplomat held talks with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh on Thursday. In a joint press conference, Amir Abdullahian said relations between the two countries are on the right track and progressing. Meanwhile, bin Farhan confirmed that the Saudi embassy in Tehran had resumed operations, which he described as another step in the development of relations between the two countries. The Saudi consulate in the northeastern city of Mashhad started its activities as well. At the end of his trip, top Iranian diplomat said he found the Saudi authorities with a different than in the past, adding that the Saudis are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. In a social media post, the Iranian foreign minister hailed the discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. Amir Abdullahian's visit to Saudi Arabia was significant, as it was the first time the top Iran diplomat visited the kingdom since the signing of a Chinese brokered deal between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties in March. Tehran and Riyadh severed ties in 2016 after protests broke out in Iran over Riyadh's execution of senior cleric Nimr al-Nimr.
Now, analysts say that the visit of the Iranian foreign minister to Saudi Arabia and the reopening of the two sides' embassies lend important confidence-building measures. Iran and Saudi Arabia hold significant power and influence in the region. The question is how this restoration and expansion of ties would affect the West Asia region and beyond.
The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi has focused on the expansion of ties with neighboring states, a policy which will, among other things, help Tehran benefit from the capacities of other countries. The latest thawing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, two prominent countries on either sides of the Persian Gulf, is in line with this policy of President Raisi's administration. The re-establishment of diplomatic relations between the two heavyweights has become a source of concern for Israel and the West over the past months as the duration of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Riyadh grew more serious. Arab countries have notably shifted their attitudes toward Iran, demonstrating a clear interest in deepening their relationship with Tehran. And at the same time, this development has raised concerns among Israel and its Western allies. Furthermore, an additional cause for their apprehension lies in the potential collaboration between Iran and Saudi Arabia in addressing the Palestinian issue, which poses a threat to Israel's political influence and propaganda efforts. Another source of worry pertains to economic and energy matters. Iran holds one of the world's largest reserves of natural gas, while Saudi Arabia is the leading oil producer. Consequently, Tehran and Riyadh could potentially play a joint role in the energy sector in the near future, the outcomes of which remain unclear for Western countries. In the realm of international affairs, embassy activities are considered temporary, and having an embassy alone does not necessarily reflect the quality of relations between two nations. However, the Saudi invitation to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the kingdom demonstrates Riyadh's keenness to enhance relations with Tehran.
Time now to take a look at developments in Pakistan. Police there have arrested the former foreign minister and senior opposition leader Shah Mahmood Qureshi in Islamabad. The reason for the arrest is not clear yet, but it came hours after the opposition leader said that he would challenge any delay in the upcoming parliament election in courts. Qureshi is the vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. His party has condemned the arrest. Pakistan has been in the midst of a political crisis since the district court sentenced former prime minister and party leader Imran Khan to 3 years in jail on graft charges and barred him politics for years. All right, now let's go to Islamabad to our correspondent Nasser Kazemi. Nasser, Mr. Qureshi is a party member, was a close aide and associate of former prime minister Imran Khan. It was his administration's foreign minister also, and they shared the same party. So he's now being arrested. Tell us about that more, and maybe we should expect more such arrests, huh?
Shah Mahmood Qureshi, who was the vice chair of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, the party of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan, and he has been serving as a foreign minister of Pakistan in two tenure. Initially, he was in the Pakistan People's Party, and he has been serving the party as a foreign minister, and later, he joined Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, and he was the foreign minister in Imran Khan's government. So he was arrested by the Federal Intelligence Agency on the charges of leaking the secret act, which is also known as a cipher, in which the former prime minister Imran Khan has been blaming the United States for hedging their conspiracy against his government through a vote of no confidence in April last year. Khan has been accusing the United States for this cipher, that through a cipher, the United States hedged a conspiracy against his government. And he alleged the former military ruler, General Bajwa, as well as the former prime minister, Shah Sharif, that they were involved in this conspiracy. However, Khan allegations were also heard in his rallies, in which he stated clearly that the United States hedged a conspiracy against his government and thrown him out of power with the help of United States. So afterwards, we have seen that there was an anger in Pakistan against the United States because Imran Khan was keep blaming the United States for hedging this conspiracy against his government. After we have seen that in this government, the government has launched a massive campaign against the Imran Khan's party and arrested majority of its leaders, including the party chief Imran Khan, who is in prison at the moment over graft charges. And we have seen that the senior leadership of Pakistan Tehreek Insaf party were also arrested after they vandalized the key installations, including the military installations in Pakistan on May 9th, when the Khan was arrested first time on the charges of corruption. Okay. So afterwards, now we have seen that the key leaders of Pakistan Tehreek Insaf party has joined another political groups, and at the ground there is, only two or three leaders are available from Pakistan Tehreek Insaf party. However, the rest have joined another political groups. Now we have seen that this arrest was came on the time when the general elections are sure to be held in November this year. However, there are still many questions and concerns raised by the political parties that the elections could be delayed in the country because the economic situation of Pakistan is not suitable at the moment, and holding the fresh elections in November could be delayed because this economic situation is getting bad to worse every day. So the Mr. Qureshi was arrested today, and a heavy police contingent was present when he was arrested and taken to custody of Federal Investigation Agency, okay, known as FIA, and he will be interrogated about the cipher issue.
Okay, Nasser, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for that. Nasser Kazem, correspondent in Islamabad.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The August 2023 BRICS summit in South Africa unfolds against a backdrop of an attempt by the Western media to project it as a divided club. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of VION, Morocco has officially submitted its bid to join the BRICS grouping, or Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This comes ahead of next week's much-anticipated summit in South Africa. With this, the Kingdom of Morocco joins other nations like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, and Egypt, which are also vying for a spot in the economic alliance. The upcoming summit in South Africa will bring together around 60 heads of state and will set expansionary standards for possible new BRICS members. However, as per CoinGabe, the final decision on which countries will join the grouping will probably be deferred. Talking to Bloomberg, South Africa's BRICS ambassador Anil Sukhlal clarified that the upcoming summit's focus will be on promoting local currencies within the bloc. Sukhlal said trading in local currencies is clearly on the agenda. He added that there is no de-dollarization agenda item on the BRICS agenda. He said that contrary to some narratives making the rounds, the bloc is not a counter to the West or G7. Instead, he said the alliance aims to advance the agenda of the Global South and build a more inclusive, representative, just and fair global architecture. According to South Africa's top diplomat in charge of relations with the bloc, more than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the BRICS group of nations. Nations that express interest include Iran, Argentina, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Cuba, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Comoros, Gabon, and Kazakhstan. Previously in July, Algeria applied for a spot in the bloc and also submitted a request to become a shareholder member of the BRICS Bank. The North African nation, as per a Reuters report, seeks to join the economic alliance to open up new economic opportunities. Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune, as quoted by Nahar TV, said, "We officially applied to join the BRICS group. We sent a letter asking to be shareholder member in the bank. Algeria's first contribution in the bank will be $1.5 billion. Reuters reports that the nation, which is rich in oil and gas reserves, is seeking to diversify its economy and also strengthen its partnership with countries like China. BRICS, which comprises Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, accounts for more than 40% of the world's population and about 26% of the global economy. Middle East Monitor also noted 8 Arab countries have officially applied to join the BRICS group of fast-developing economies, the South African foreign minister said. Naledi Pandor told reporters that a total of 23 countries have officially applied to join the group, including 8 Arab countries, noting that BRICS leaders will discuss expanding the group and the submitted applications during their upcoming summit between August 22nd to 24th. Pandor said South Africa, as chairman of BRICS, will hold talks at the summit on the enlargement model, its principles and standards. We are gradually moving towards consensus on BRICS expansion issues, and we hope to reach it at the summit. Algeria, Bahrain, Egypt, Kuwait, Morocco, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE were named as the countries that applied. The remaining countries are Iran, Kazakhstan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Senegal, Ethiopia, Belarus, Bolivia, Argentina, Venezuela, Vietnam, Cuba, Honduras, Indonesia, and Thailand. According to Daily News Egypt, the 15th BRICS summit to be held in South Africa this month is expected to make the global governance system fairer and counterbalance the dominance of Western countries. Carlos Maria Corroa, executive director of the South Center, told Xinhua news agency recently. The event's agenda will be topped by efforts toward de-dollarization, reducing the U.S. dollar's hegemony, and the expansion of the bloc, Korea said. The BRICS group of major emerging economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will hold its 15th Heads of State and Government Summit in Johannesburg between August 22nd to August 24th. The summit will be the first in-person BRICS gathering since the COVID-19 pandemic. Altogether, the BRICS nations account for more than 40% of the world's population and about 26% of the global economy. Correa said one key issue for the BRICS to consider is global governance. There is a need to change the current system, which is unfair and asymmetric. In particular, the architecture of the financial system needs a major reform. Leaders are also expected to discuss the group's expansion by adding new members, including the admission criteria and the guiding principles. Correa said, among my hopes is that the current BRICS group considers the incorporation of other currencies. This will be very important because it will give volume to the BRICS group. Of course, major economies such as those of India, Brazil, and China are there. But if other countries can also be incorporated, the political dimension of the BRICS will be improved significantly.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Rouhani are the guest speakers for today's discussion. Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. It's nice to be here.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the other aspects of the post-Ashura events, especially the atrocities and the cruelties that were done against the kids and the youngsters over there. We know that in this tragedy that took place in the year 61 AH, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions were martyred, and so many of the family members and the companions and the families, the girls, daughters, we can say boys, teenagers, were taken as the captive long, long way from Karbala to Levant, Shamat, in order to be present at the palace of Yazid. Now, what happened to the kids over there? How many kids were over there? Who were the most important personalities and the youngsters who were present at Karbala? Let's start with Sheikh Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, of course, there were many kids, but just some of them are mentioned in the historical sources. Like, for example, children of Muslim ibn Aqil, they were present in Karbala. And also the children of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Some of the names are mentioned, like Ali Asghar, some of the daughters of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, and the children of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wasalam, and children of Zainab salamullahi alayha. So there were many kids.
Yes.
Some of them were killed very brutally, like, for example, Ali Asghar salamullahi alayhi. On the day of Ashura. Of course, so we know about that. And also the other kids who were killed in the Battle of Karbala, that was one of the son of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba,
yes,
whose name was Abdullah. He was in the last moment of the life of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, when he came to protect Imam against the enemies. So he, in that actually last moment of life of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, this kid was killed in the presence of the Imam. And also the kids of Zainab, salamullah alayha, they were also killed.
Was Qasim also a youngster?
Qasim was also like a young boy, yeah. He was also, okay. He was not a kid. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was a young man. Okay. And then the rest of the kids, they were taken as captives and they were unfortunately tortured, and they were taken as captives. Some of them were taken as slaves, unfortunately. This way they behaved with the children of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. And one of the kids who were present in the Karbala was Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wassalam.
How old was he on that time?
He was like 5 years old.
5 years old on that
time. Yeah, of course. Okay. He witnessed all what happened in Karbala. That's why we see that after the event of Ashura, he was always actually holding this kind of, what you can say,
ceremonies.
Sad kind of ceremonies, commemorating the event of Karbala. Mm-hmm. And what is really interesting about Imam al-Baqir is that in the castle of Yazid, when actually Yazid brought all the Usara or the captives, then there was a dialogue between Yazid and Imam al-Baqir that I will mention, inshallah, in the next part.
Yes. Okay, we'll get to that dialogue, inshallah. Really, we can say the atrocity was is to up maximum, we can say, level on that. Nobody did such a thing, even to the kids on that time. We can say the Arabs were famous for fighting for, you know, here and there. But nobody has ever witnessed such a scene before that they, for example, do cruelty or atrocity against the kids present, for example, in a battlefield. And who were those kids? You know, the grandchildren of Prophet Muhammad. This was really shocking for the whole Muslim community. Not only up to an extent that even some Umayyads criticize Yazid's behavior now, that what kind of behavior is this towards the Ahlul Bayt. The Sayyid Mahdi, was this a revenge, for example, from the family of Ahlul Bayt? We have never seen such a case from the side of Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt against the Umayyads. Why the Umayyads will do such actions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So it's an important question, and it's interesting that why, for example, the Umayyads would do these kind of atrocities. There's a kind of a historical background that needs to be taken into consideration. The third caliph Uthman, he appoints Muawiyah as the governor of Syria. And right from the beginning, we find that Muawiyah in the Levant, as you called it, which is a large area in the present-day Syria, parts of Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, and much wider as well. It was a big, wealthy province on the outskirts of Byzantium at that time. So right from the beginning, he started to do this kind of propaganda against the Ahlul Bayt on one hand. On the other hand, they would claim themselves to be a part of the Ahlul Bayt. Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting propaganda strategy that they had tried to do, one, to bring down the Ahlul Bayt, to the point where, for example, where Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he is martyred in the masjid in Kufa at the time of prayers, the people in the Levant and in the Shamat, they would ask what was Ali doing in the masjid in the first place.
But why will the Umayyads will kill, for example, children?
Well, see,
you know?
So that's where I'm going, right? So over time, then you have Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and then the amount of propaganda that was done against him is probably more so than they did with Imam Ali. So by the time you get to Imam Hussein alayhi salam's imamat, these children are not necessarily considered those very divine figures or the holy prophets, Ahlul Bayt. They're considered, you know, as
the family,
I guess,
members.
Well, just, I don't know, you know, they take away that soul and that spirit of Islam from these individuals. So when they, for example, when these children got to Kufa or Sham, they called them rebels against Islam. They called them rebels against the Khalifa of Allah, supposedly Yazid, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this this propaganda that brainwashes an individual to no longer see a human being as a human being. And I know it might be a large jump, but this is the same thing that you see in the present day with terrorist organizations, whether it's Daesh or Al-Qaeda or even Taliban. It's not easy for you to go and torture a child or to kill a child or to put some kind of suffering. What you have to do is psychologically and via propaganda take that humanity out of that child, so you don't longer. And this is what the Umayyads did.
Okay.
They took this aspect out that these are rebels, these are the enemies of Allah. And so we find this kind of atrocities being committed against children.
That's right. It is even recorded that some of the children passed away on this way because of the hardships, you know, afflictions.
Not only did they pass away, in some of the traditions you find that because they were trying to get to Kufa and then later on to Sham as fast as they could, they would make the camels and the horses, right? But they put them on camels.
Yes.
It would make them ride faster.
Faster.
And so the movement of a camel is such that it's very bumpy, it's very jumpy, and some of these kids actually fell into the desert.
Fell into the desert.
Onto the way, and of course they were martyred.
That's right. And see, for example, about 20 days before, they had such a respect because they were respected as the family of Prophet Muhammad, and now they're respected in this way. Hussein, Hussein. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, two important figures, as you said, Imam Muhammad al-Baghir's dialogue and Hadrat Ruqayya. In some of the documents, it is mentioned that she was 3 years old and she passed away some days after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his father. Let's talk a little bit about these two personalities.
Yes, according to the narrations and the reports from the event of Karbala, one of the children of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam passed away in the place nowadays called Hilla.
Yes.
And she was buried there. Now his tomb, his ziyarah, is very well known. He of course, passed away in the way to Sham. And the other one was, of course, another daughter of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, who was martyred in Sham when they brought the head of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam into the presence of this child. And of course, she couldn't tolerate and she died out of seeing that kind of face
tragic
of his father.
Right.
A tragic and sad, very sad scene of the Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi wasalam. And of course, the other child whose role is very significant and important is Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, who was like 5 years old in Karbala. He was present with his father, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam. You see that if we look at this event from eyes of a child who is present in that kind of, let's say, desert, and he witnesses those sort of scenes, particularly all the things that happened to his father.
Yes.
It is narrated that in Kufa, Ibn Ziyad once wanted to kill Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam. He tried a lot. And then it is said that Lady Zainab put herself as a ha'il between, between, let's say, Ibn Ziyad. And then Ibn Ziyad decided to kill Zainab, salamullahi alayha. Then some of the advisors of Ibn Ziyad said that, are you going to kill a lady, a woman? It's a shame on you. Then he stopped not killing Lady Zainab.
Okay.
So all these scenes are witnessed by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam. But despite this, see how strong was Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, that in the castle of Yazid, when Yazid wanted to kill Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, because there was a dialogue between Imam al-Sajjad and Yazid, and then Yazid became really angry and decided to kill Imam al-Sajjad. Then Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stood up against Yazid and started talking to Yazid in the presence of Yazid and all the, let's say, wazara, ministers or official kind of ambassadors, all of them were present there.
Okay.
So he, as a child, as a 5 or 6 years old child, stood up and started talking to Yazid. He mentioned very nice points to Yazid, said that, oh, Yazid, you are worse than Pharaoh. Then Yazid said, why? How do you say that? Imam said that because once Pharaoh wanted to kill Musa alayhi salam, then his advisors told Pharaoh that you should not kill a prophet. It is not true. Then Pharaoh listened to his advisor and not kill the prophet Musa alayhi salatu wasalam. But now you do not listen to your advisors while they are advising you to not kill son of the prophet, Imam al-Sajjad. And that is why you're worse than Pharaoh, because you want to kill son of the prophet while your advisors, now we hear that they advise you that do not kill. That's why I said, how do you prove that? He said that it's mentioned in the Holy Quran, O Yazid. You didn't read the Holy Quran. This is the story that I'm just narrating from the Holy Quran. And then he mentioned the ayat of the Holy Quran about the Pharaoh and then
so a child at the age of five
of course.
Is teaching of course. A king, a so-called
yeah,
king.
Yeah, and he stopped Yazid. He stopped Yazid from killing his father. And he protected the life of Imam Sajjad, a six-year-old child. By this kind of strong argumentation against Yazid, the caliph, the king, in the prisons of lots of people the castle of Yazid. Yeah.
Okay.
This way he protected the emir.
Very good. And this is the main question, Sayyid Mahdi. Some people might say that, okay, the Imam al-Hussein or Imam al-Sajjad, for example, were the imams. So what about the kid? How do you consider, for example, Ali al-Asghar to, we can say, that's right. You want Shafa, for example, from a kid, a six-year-old kid like Ali al-Asghar, or, for example, the other kids over there, they were not ma'asum or something like that. Okay, this is a major question that is posed by some people all across the world. I mean, the holiness of these characters is not related only to the bloodline. It is related to the sacrifice that they made for the sake of Islam. If there was no, for example, kid over there or Ali al-Asghar, maybe there was nothing remaining out of the religion of Islam, isn't it?
Yes, I agree there that these individuals that were not the imams, for example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam or Imam Baqir alayhi salam or Imam Hussain alayhi salam, these other individuals, so Hazrat Abbas ibn Ali, also alayhi salam, Lady Zainab salamullah alayha, these individuals might not have been imams, but they were at a very high level of spirituality, a very high level of purity. And so even though we can't really make a direct comparison, but there's people that we see in the present day also that are very pure, that are very holy, that are very spiritual, you know, and these individuals have a very special connection with the Almighty Allah because of their spirituality and their purity.
Ali al-Asghar is called Babul Hawa'ij, you know.
Right, Hazrat Abbas is called Babul Hawa'ij, yes. Ali al-Asghar is called Babul Hawa'ij. And it is because, as you said, this great sacrifice that they made, but as well as their purity and their spirituality and their basira, their insight that they had, how well they followed the imam of their time. These are all things that play a factor. One thing I wanted to add to the previous discussion that we were having, you know, how is it possible for you to gather, 10, 12, 13,000 soldiers to come and not only kill people who are relatively defenseless, right, 72 or so against 13,000, you consider 72 to be defenseless.
Yes, yes.
There's no physical way that they can win against 13,000 or 10,000 soldiers, right? One thing that a lot of times we don't take into consideration, and it's something that Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, he himself said. He said that your bellies, your stomachs, are filled with haram. Mm-hmm. They are filled with that which is prohibited. And this is something we don't take into consideration. This is apart from that psychological propaganda that has infected these individuals to the point where they are willing to kill the grandson of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. The other one is this idea of haram income and eating that which is haram. And these two things together have corrupted that individual where there's no humanity left in them, and the result is Ashura and Karbala.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding some of the other details of the post-Ashura events, especially the misbehaviors that were done against the children and the youngsters over there in 61 AH. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. See another episode. God bless you all. Fi aman.
الله أكبر جبتني الكربلة خويا يا حسين دشوف العائلة الله أكبر جبتني الكربلة
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Afghan officials say 195,000 people have been left maimed by drone strikes and cluster bomb incidents in Afghanistan during two decades of war in the country. It's estimated that during the first 3 years of the conflict, the United States dropped more than 1,500 cluster bombs in Afghanistan. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The China Global Television Network, CGTN, has covered this story and tells us more. The globally banned mass-destructive cluster bombs dropped by United States military forces in Afghanistan during their 20-year occupation of the country continue to wreak havoc among Afghans, with the unexploded bomblets still remaining a major life-threatening risk to Afghan civilians. According to the CGTN report on Saturday, 15th of July, the Afghan Ministry of Martyrs and Disabled Affairs has declared there are currently 195,000 registered maimed individuals in Afghanistan, the majority of whom are victims of cluster bombs and drone strikes across the country during the US-led military occupation of the country. It is estimated that during the first 3 years of the destructive invasion, American military forces dropped more than 1,500 cluster bombs across Afghanistan. A senior official of the ministry pointed out, unexploded ordnances from cluster bombs dropped by U.S. military forces continue to cause fatalities and injuries years, even decades, after the munitions were launched. The United States, despite its purported and hyped-up advocacy for human rights, remains amongst the countries of the world that has refused to sign the convention banning the use of cluster munitions due to the long-term risk to the civilian population, even after the conflict has ended. Referring to fighters resisting the US-led invasion, the Afghan ministry's chief of staff, Qari Shah Mohammad, said, "We don't have exact data on the number of Afghans maimed by the use of cluster bombs, but in fact, many cases of disabilities, including those suffered by the Taliban militias, are a result of airstrikes, including drone attacks and cluster bombs." Qari Shah Mohammad further emphasized that the United States has committed many war crimes in Afghanistan, but it has not used nuclear bombs. According to the report, among the civilian victims of cluster bombs dropped in Afghanistan is 27-year-old Soleiman, who was struck by a cluster bomb while playing in the Jalrez district of eastern Wardak province during his childhood. He noted that all he can now recall is the trauma and the intense pain that he experienced at the time. He said, "When I heard the sounds of bombardment, I was totally frightened. I was just 6 years old at the time. A bomb struck me in the back, and I have been disabled ever since." The report further identified Asadullah as yet another civilian victim of a similar incident, explaining that he was on his way back home with his classmates when a leftover cluster bomblet detonated, killing three of his classmates and mutilating his own arm. Following the tragedy, Asadullah went on to complete his education in India, earning a bachelor's degree in mining engineering. However, he still continues to visit psychiatrists for mental treatment due to the horrific incidents that he experienced back in 2011. He stressed, "I was admitted to hospital, and when I opened my eyes, I realized that I had lost one of my arms. It remains the most traumatic memory in my life." The China Global Television Network report goes on to say that U.S. President Joe Biden recently signed off on supplying Ukraine with cluster bombs for use against Russian forces, despite knowing the enormous trauma and mass destructive weapon had inflicted on the civilian population in various wars. Ukrainian media outlets reported on Saturday, 15th of July, that Kiev has already received shipments of the weapon. The report further cited Afghan military expert Abdulwahid Taqat as expressing apprehension over Washington's decision to supply cluster bombs to Kiev. Taqat asserted, "It's a tremendous human tragedy, and this tragedy has been brought about by the United States and its allies, including Britain and various other countries that have all come together under the NATO structure. They have adopted it as their policy, which is very treacherous." Washington's controversial decision to send banned cluster bombs to Ukraine took place despite widespread international condemnation and strong opposition by several of Washington's NATO allies, including Britain, Spain, Canada, and Germany. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak pointed out that Britain remained committed to the international convention that prohibits the use and production of cluster munitions, unlike the United States, Russia, and Ukraine. Rishi Sunak voiced his opposition to supplying cluster munitions to Ukraine by insisting that London will not follow Washington's lead on this matter. Prime Minister Sunak said London will instead press allied governments to boost their military aid to Kiev in other ways. The International Convention on Cluster Munitions, which has been endorsed by more than 120 countries, bans the use of the massively destructive cluster bombs. The New York Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former U.S. officials and military analysts have said that globally banned cluster bombs won't have a significant impact on the situation in Ukraine on the front lines in the short run, echoing remarks made by former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer Scott Ritter. Citing military experts, the U.S. Daily reported on Friday, 14th of July, that the controversial weaponry will not immediately help Ukraine's offensive and would only allow Kiev's troops to hold out as they face a drastic ammunition shortage. Jack Watling, a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London, said, "The scale of effect will be modest." He added, "The real impact could be only seen when Ukraine has significantly more ammunition." U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carl has said that the cluster munitions would just allow Ukraine to sustain the artillery fight for the foreseeable future. The analysts are saying that Ukrainian troops are likely to use cluster munitions to sustain the high rate of artillery fire as they revert to Soviet-style heavy artillery shelling of Russian positions. Amiel Kotlarsky of the Defense Intelligence Company, Jane's, told the newspaper, "It looks like they're back to an artillery duel." The New York Times reported senior U.S. officials had privately expressed frustration over the issue in recent weeks, adding that the artillery duel strategy is less efficient and more costly. The United States announced on July the 7th that it would send Kiev cluster munitions as part of an $800 million security package intended to help Ukrainian forces against Russia, despite concerns about the long-term risk posed to civilians. U.S. President Joe Biden said recently that the decision to provide the munitions was very difficult, but that Ukrainian forces were running out of ammunition. On Thursday, 13th of July, former United Nations Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter said that Washington's decision to provide Ukraine with the cluster bombs is an act of aggression. Scott Ritter added that the munitions will make Ukraine weaker for two reasons. One, there will be less impact than a conventional high-explosive round. They will have a less destructive impact on the Russians. And the second reason is that they're going to prompt a Russian countermeasure, which is going to be in the form of improved cluster munitions used by the Russians. He added, "The Russians currently have a tenfold superiority in artillery terms over the Ukrainians. Ukraine is about to find itself saturated with cluster bomb units, which is going to result in higher casualty rates on the part of the Ukrainians."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.